Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm thrilled to continue the series we've been doing on Eric Samuelson. It may seem strange to spend so much time on a playwright. They aren't really public celebrities anymore. I mean, name the playwrights you know. Shakespeare, right? And Arthur Miller, because you had to read them in high school. And if you were in the drama club, maybe you remember Tennessee Williams, or Marsha Norman, or Tony Kushner, or David Henry Hwang. But it's really likely that I've lost most of you by now. So, why so many episodes on Eric? Well, hopefully you've started to see how robust his plays were, how insightful and how worthy of interpretation, and how accessible. I mean, reading a play by Eric is not at all like taking cod liver oil. He's funny and compelling and a fantastic storyteller. He just happened to work in a medium that isn't very popular these days. In this episode, we'll be focusing on peculiarities, subtitled Weird Mormon Sex. Yeah, you were waiting for us to get to this one, huh? If you're interested, you can go read Peculiarities first before listening to this podcast. You can find it at sunstone.org/Eric. But, unlike high school English class, we've set up the discussion today so that you can enjoy it even if you haven't read the play itself. To give us insight into this play, Jerry Rapier has joined us. He's the artistic director for Plan B Theater in Salt Lake City, which was Eric's artistic home for many years. Jerry even mounted an entire season dedicated to Eric's work, which I was smart enough to attend. Jerry directed Peculiarities for both stage and film. So, thanks for joining us, Jerry. Tell us briefly how you and Eric started working together.
Well, in 2003, we decided to create an annual event called Slam, where local playwrights would create a work overnight, and then actors, designers, and directors would work on it the next day, and then it would go up in the 24th hour of that timeline. So the entire creative process from the time they started writing until the performance ended was 24 hours. The first year, I asked local playwrights to submit a 10-minute writing sample so that we could get a sense of who the best writers for this project would be. And Eric actually sent in The Kiss from the film version of Peculiarities. It wasn't part of the stage play. It was the first piece of his writing that I ever read. The way this event worked is we would, my staff and I would create these titles, and we'd determine, like, this is the pile of props you can choose from, and this is the setting that these options with lighting and setting and sound that you can work with. And those were the prompts for creating the plays. Eric's title that he was given was The Butcher, the Beggar, and the Bedtime Buddy. It lends itself to something quite absurd, but instead what he created was this very gritty 10-minute play about a small community in Nebraska where commercial agriculture was polluting the environment. Not just the literal environment, but making the community itself, the way people interacted with each other and how they navigated the environmental pollution interpersonally, how that became toxic as well. And it was kind of breathtaking. The Butcher, the Beggar, and the Bedtime Buddy became Eric's play's Miasma that we produced in 2006. In the interim, he gave me all the rest of Peculiarities. So he had intended for The Kiss to be part of this series of short plays about the complications of being a less than perfect Mormon. I looked at all the pieces and we thought, hey, let's make a movie. I had no idea what I was doing.
Movies are easy.
Yeah, well, I didn't really know, but I had a lot of access to people, and we decided to give it a shot. And Brian Johnson underwrote the entire film, which we shot for $10,000 over the course of about somewhere around a dozen weekend shoots. We gathered a bunch of actors that were connected to Eric in some way and just dove in. So it was between 20 and 24 total days of shooting. And it was in 2006, so technology was a lot different than it is now. The film project happened before the Plan B production of Miasma. So it was actually the first time I worked directly with Eric. And some people in the film were shooting their first film ever, and there were some folks that were a huge part of the local film scene. The talent involved also ran the gamut of active, faithful LDS members, former Mormons, never Mormons, anti-Mormons. It was a big amalgam of folks, which I think made it all the richer experience for all of us. We were figuring out a whole bunch of stuff as we went and learning as we went. And there was significant issue with the audio of one particular storyline, but we had committed to screen it at a Sunstone symposium, and Eric really wanted it to be screened. We didn't really know how bad the audio was in this one particular storyline until we saw the screening at Sunstone. But then afterwards, Neil Abute was there, and he said to me, I would have never let that be screened. That was literally the first thing he ever said to me, and then we had a nice conversation after that, but it was really funny.
And you guys did go back and clean it up, I noticed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did. We did. You know, it's clean now if anybody wants to watch it on YouTube.
I'll make sure that we leave a link for that on the website. So let's dive into Peculiarities itself. We've been looking into each of these plays and kind of tried to see what it was that Eric may have been trying to say. I had planned for Eric to be in on these conversations. He and I had had a discussion about 3 weeks before he had died, and then he totally screwed up all my plans.
No.
So Peculiarities is a lot like the plan, which we discussed last episode with Melissa Leilani Larson, because it's a collection of mini plays. The first one, Tahoe, takes place in a car on the way back to Provo from Lake Tahoe. And in the car is Kendra and Ted, two BYU students who, we realize toward the end, got civilly married in Nevada, had sex all weekend, and are now on their way home to annul the marriage and get back to their Mormon lives. As Kendra says, letter of the law, we kept the law of chastity. We can honestly say that we have not had sexual relations with anyone we aren't married to.
I had one very torturous year as a BYU student. It was not the place for me. But I thought, there is no way this thing is real. People don't do that. And I found out very quickly that it actually is quite real, that in an environment where there is no opposition allowed, people still find a way to experiment and express themselves. My best friend at the time that I went, we moved here to go to BYU together, he's still very faithfully LDS. And his comment while we were students at BYU, he had wanted to go to BYU all his life. I remember him saying, he said, you know, the problem with this place is the scripture says there needs to be opposition in all things, apparently except on BYU campus. The reason I bring that up is because I think it really is what Eric is working from. It's a strange extreme from the outside to go to for a sexual tryst that many people would find simply too far to go. But for these characters and the very real students that they're inspired by, it's not that extreme. I think what surprises the characters, the shame and the guilt still comes. The Tahoe storyline isn't about them driving to Nevada, getting married and having sex and then annulling their marriage. It's what happens after, the moments after that, and how they face who they say they are, who they feel they are, and what they've done moving forward. Not, it's much less salacious than it might sound.
Yeah, you don't watch this one for kicks and giggles.
No, and it's so I think he really tapped into something here, the conflict of being a young person whose life is supposed to be mapped out for them at the Lord's University, not being able to express the questions that are inside their hearts and heads, and what that leads to.
Yeah, and one of the other plays, Nicmo, kind of looks at the same theme from a slightly different perspective, because this is Nicmo means apparently non-committal making out. And in it, there's two characters, Kim and Trent, who make out a lot on screen while they're trying to figure out why they're doing it, because both of them are actually engaged to other people. And they keep thinking, we're doing everything else right. Why are we so, I don't know, why is this such a big part of our life? Because they've been doing this together for weeks, as far as I remember, just getting together and just doing these really hot and heavy makeout sessions.
And really thinking that they're protecting themselves emotionally because they're following the quote-unquote letter of the law.
Right.
Pushing things just as far as they can, and then the line starts moving, and neither one of them wants to stop the movement. It's not as easy to turn off because they get more emotionally involved with each other, and it's not just casual anymore, and it's not just simple, and it's not something that can be set aside without possible broken heart. Again, the guilt and the shame that comes from not being able to talk about your feelings, having to express yourself who you really are in secret and present who you think other people want you to be in public.
Both of these seem to be about what happens when there is a chasm between how you present yourself to your community and what it is you're wrestling with personally. When you can't bring those two things together, they kind of stay on opposite sides of the chasm and wreak havoc on each other.
And I think that is a hallmark of Eric's work in general. He was fascinated by the space between those two things and why that isn't where we all live. Why is it far to one side or far to the other where people find themselves, instead of if more people were comfortable and able to reside in the middle of those two things, they'd have access to both sides, maybe in a healthier, more substantial way. Many times Eric and I talked about his work and his views and how they were really present or not present in his plays. He found that gulf very confusing. It was because he was so confident in how he lived his faith that he was welcoming of and energized by doubt and questions. There are a lot of people who use faith as a way to escape questions. And so seeing someone else be able to embrace questions is very threatening and in some way judgmental of them, or at least perceived as being judgmental of them. But anyone who knew Eric is the least judgmental person maybe to ever walk the earth. So it's just interesting that he was trying to explore that, and so many people saw his exploration of that. Those within the LDS Church particularly saw his exploration of that as in some way heretical, and he found it affirming.
Both of these plays and the other ones in here, if I had seen them in like a seminary video context, I would assume that these characters by the end of the story would either be repenting or else they would be a tragic example of what happens when you don't follow the commandments. But in Eric's plays, he doesn't seem to be casting that judgment. He seems to be putting us in this place where it's rough, and no matter what happens, it's rough. He seems to be affirming the roughness of being a Mormon in particular contexts.
You know, using the reference of seminary videos, or I am old enough to have watched a film strip or two in my time, those are never about discovering your moral. They're about reinforcing or placing a moral. And I think Eric is much more, in this case, in the work of Peculiarities in particular, was interested in exploring how people arrive at their own moral compass, how they discover it and navigate it and learn how to use it. Religious folk that I have known in over the 50 years I've been alive generally think they're helping people find their moral compass, but really they're just really saying the one I have is the one you should use. That doesn't always work out so well. People have to find it themselves in order to truly be guided by it. Otherwise, I think there's always a little, there's a fear, which turns into judgment. Those who really understand their own moral compass aren't threatened by views that are different than theirs or journeys that follow a different path than their own. You know, the great conundrum, how could he be a liberal Democrat and be a faithful Mormon? Well, because he was.
Reading is weird. It takes up your whole body. You can't walk, you have to hold a book in your hands, and you have to look at words the whole time. That's why you have me. I'm Stephen Carter, the host of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. I narrate Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry for you, so you can do dishes, or rock climb, or drive your Ferrari, or skydive. Whatever it is you like to do while listening to the best of Mormon thought and experience. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. And then join the We Do Fun Stuff While Learning About Mormon Stuff Club. I'll see you there. And what you just brought up is pretty interesting about people getting their own moral compass, developing their own moral compass, because we see that in its beginning stages in temps. It takes place in an office where two temps, Alexis and Jason, are flirting. The problem is Alexis is married and has a young child. But the thing is, her husband is obsessed with his thesis right now, and her child is very needy. And so she's feeling really lonely. And having this chance to, you know, do some low-stakes flirting with this guy who's very interested in flirting with her, she's starting to understand just how lonely she is and just how many needs aren't being met by the morality that was handed to her. She's starting into that process of saying, what do I need to do in order to not be this lonely?
It's such a gentle, beautiful storyline that I think almost anyone can identify with. And Eric asks a really hard question that's at the core of Mormonism about marriage. Marriage is taught to be the answer to all the things. But what Eric says in that play is, if you don't marry the right person, what's the point? If you don't marry someone that you are equal, feel equal to, feel compatible with, feel connected to, someone you want to build a life with, and within Mormon theology, the build an eternal life with, what's the point? If you're married to somebody that you discover you don't have anything in common with, eternity isn't a very exciting prospect. What serves a marriage and parenthood, and thus the children that you bring into the world within that marriage, better? Marriage first, and then getting to know yourself and your spouse? Or is it possible that maybe getting married to the first person who says yes as young as possible might not be the best answer for everyone? For many people, it works. But marriage is such a complicated thing. With something that complicated, how can there possibly be a template that fits everyone? And maybe in Alexis's case, if she'd taken just a little more time to get to know herself, she would be more comfortable and capable inside a marriage and as a parent. She might have married a different person that was more of a fit for her.
You're right. It is very much about a template being impressed upon some people's lives and sort of what it leaves out, which parts of you get starved in the process of being conformed to that shape.
I mean, of course, I mean, the most complicated thing about marriage is compromise. But there's compromise and then there's the sacrifice of yourself. And if you can't have an identity within your marriage, what kind of parent can you be?
That's exactly what I was feeling in there, was that she was without an identity and speaking about things that really made her interested and excited and intrigued. She was finally saying, oh, bits of my identity, and now I have to go home to a husband who was fulfilling his role as a good provider. He's getting his education. The future looks financially stable. I have this child, and I need to take care of the child because that's my job. And then where is the room for her development? And she's feeling that lack of development, which is why she's so intrigued by this guy who's kind of a geek, but she's still going for it. Because he's bringing up a part of herself that she'd forgotten about.
Part of it is the forbidden nature of it all and the risk. It's tantalizing, but it's also in very small, simple conversations. He understands her far better than her husband does. And if she's willing to marry someone who doesn't know her, doesn't see her, what does that say about how well she knows and sees herself?
And that sort of brings us to the kiss, because it's about a very strange place in a marriage much later on. It takes place in a car as well in Nevada, where Rita and Barry, a husband and a wife, are driving toward a spot where they're going to meet someone who will take Rita to a Nevada brothel where she's going to work for the next 3 weeks. The problem is that Barry lost his job, and this is the only way that Rita can see to keep the family afloat. And I'll have to admit, this is the play that's like most cognitively dissonant for me. It was really difficult for me to imagine a Mormon woman saying, you know, honey, these are hard times. I'm going to go work at a brothel to make ends meet. I don't know. What did you think of that, Jerry? Was that too far?
If we look at the arc of the women in each of these short plays and then collectively the impact of them, what we see, how much women have, or if they have, power within their marriages, within their relationships, within the church, because it is so stringently a patriarchal society, a patriarchal culture, a patriarchal faith. And that makes a lot of people bristle. I heard all my formative years, behind every man is a good woman. Behind every,
right.
Well, what is the phrase? Behind every good man is a good woman. Well, If she's the one driving the goodness, why is she standing behind the fool, right? Like, why is her job to prop him up? Why isn't he behind her? Why isn't she at the forefront? Why do we have to pretend that we don't know the dynamic because of their gender? Why don't women have equal power in this scenario? Why do we have to say this thing that everybody says, well, my dad thinks he's in charge, but my mom really makes all the decisions? So if that's the way, and we all know it, why are we pretending that it's the opposite of that? I think that's ultimately what Eric is exploring, is the very different ways that men and women are able to tackle and express any sort of dissonance, cognitive or otherwise, within a faith culture. And in this particular case, she has to act because he's incapable of acting. Her concerns, as this imminent changeover is happening, as she's waiting for her transportation to arrive to take her to the brothel, she's concerned about him understanding the kid's schedule. She's concerned about him being responsible and stepping up in a way that he doesn't. It's an opportunity for him to be better at that. And he is seeing what she's doing only through the lens of how it affects him. So he can't really hear what she's actually saying to him, that she's willing to do anything to take care of their family, and he is not. So get them to school on time is what I'm asking of you. For whatever reason, he thinks it's equal. This is a hypothetical situation through and through, but sometimes the extremes help us examine really where our loyalties and boundaries truly lie. It's not so far-fetched when you think about the entire practice of polygamy, for example. To me, of the two things, 3 weeks working in a brothel is far, far less complicated than, I don't know, half a dozen women being available sexually to one man. That is an undeniable imbalance of power. The question in the play is really, where is the balance? And we need maybe an extreme situation that almost everybody would recoil from to look at why we're recoiling and who it is we care about in this situation.
You can look into your own marriage and say, is my wife way more dedicated to this than I am? We're not talking about whether a Mormon woman would do this or not. We're talking about how an imbalance of power affects both the women and the men, and how that looks in metaphor. How far are women willing to go to do something that the man is supposed to be equally committed to?
Yeah, it's a parable.
Oh, there you go. It's a parable.
If you phrase it in that way and put it in that category, it's kind of like middle ground parable, right? There's some crazy stuff happening in biblical parables that make this seem quaint and easy to navigate.
Nice little Mormon parable.
Yeah. And it, isn't it interesting? This makes you really uncomfortable, but it's a very similar to a story in the strangely embraced by the larger Mormon community musical Les Miserables. I've never understood that almost obsessive embrace of
Fantine.
That musical, but at the center of that is the same story.
It's the same story. She's just not Mormon, so we can totally go with it. She's like, she's French.
So it's the gender lens again. We turn a blind eye a lot easier to a male indiscretion than to a female one, because deep down, faith communities are patriarchal, where the power belongs to the men, and the women's role is to uphold them, serve them, make them better, but not necessarily have those things reciprocated in a real way. Maybe in a performative public way, but not in a truly real private day-to-day nuts and bolts way.
They get thanked at testimony meeting.
Right. It's kind of like the 2019 version of that is long-winded posts on birthdays on Facebook. But what does that say? What is why, you know, Facebook is so performative.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
So it's interesting that we've been talking so much about heteronormative relationships, because pizza and a movie reveals the longing, the loneliness of people who can't fit into that in many different ways. It's about, Carlene and Courtney. So these are two BYU students who are, as usual, without dates on a Saturday night. So they stay home for pizza and a movie. And by the end, it's obvious that both of them are heading into permanent single adulthood in a church that prizes marriage, as we've been talking about. But Carlene has an idea that's so unthinkable in LDS culture that she's only willing to propose it to Courtney after she's fallen asleep, which is, you know, let's get together, me and you.
Yeah, she's in love with her, and she can't express that. She can barely express it to herself. much less to the object of her affection when she's awake. So she has to whisper it in her ear while she's asleep. It's a very complicated issue, to say the least. It continues to be, is, you know, as a, you know, this month, it continued to be complicated for the relationship between the LGBTQ folks and the LDS Church is one fraught with complication. It is definitely a one step forward, four steps back type of relationship. It's a very dysfunctional. It's sometimes less about the faith than it is about the culture. And that's really difficult for some people to understand who have not been involved. The intention of being Mormon is that it is all, it is your entire identity, not a part of who you are, but it is, it dictates every element of your life and inhabits and fills all the corners. And how do you step away from that when there, you don't know if you're ever stepping towards something? It's lovely that Eric tackles it in the way that he does, and in a context that's very, very easy to plop yourself in the center of. So in context, when we shot the film, it was a little over 2 years before the passage of Prop 8 in California. It was 4 years after the passage of Amendment 3 in Utah. And he's very much responding to the that chasm, to borrow your term from earlier, that was widening and continues to widen. But we're seeing now in within Mormon culture, there are now there are mama dragons. Now there's Encircle. Now there are, it is not possible not to have the conversation anymore. Even at the time of that we worked on this piece, and certainly when it was performed in Springville a couple of years before that, it was at a time when the choice between church and child was, it was a given that the church would be chosen. And that is not the choice people are making now. Some people, yes, but not everyone. And far more people are deciding that no one should be pressing them to make that choice in the first place. In a little tiny way, Eric saw where that was headed before a lot of other people did. It means everything to me that it is a female couple, a potentially a potential couple. They're not a couple yet. It may never be, because in the big scheme of things, as far as LGBTQ stories go, gay male stories are at the forefront. Female stories, lesbian stories are not nearly as often told, much less those of those bisexual individuals and certainly of trans individuals. And he saw the need and the power of approaching it in a less familiar way. One of the reasons that the short plays as a whole are referred to as peculiarities is because the self-named peculiar people, and then the root word of peculiar is liar.
Really?
So how do you anoint yourself with a name that also means that you don't tell the truth?
I had no idea that that was the case.
That well, now it'll is, be all you see when you look at the word.
It's all I see. One of the things that you guys did with the movie was that Eric added in another story that's apparently kind of impossible to read on the page, which is about a bishop who's trying to have a romantic evening with his wife, and it just keeps getting interrupted by phone calls from ward members and things like that. So that in the end, they end up just going to bed because it never really worked out. And that's kind of a sad one to me. But it's also a really interesting flip of that normal story that we hear about the bishop and his wife who sacrifice their creature comforts for the ward. And right. Then here we get to see it in real frustrating time.
It's the great conundrum of a lay ministry and a focus on family. You can only truly fulfill your calling with hours away from your family. The higher level that calling is, the more time that requires. And at the level of a bishop, you're expected to be available to hundreds of people at all hours while still having a family. You can't be bishop and not have a family. And, you know, obviously earn a living. The service to one individual is a loss to another. If you're the bishop that people refer to as the one that just is there for them and that they can count on and they feel really connected to and really sees them and cares for them and shepherds them, that all happens at the expense of that bishop's family. My own husband's family experienced this a lot. His dad was a very young bishop and a very young stake president. And all of that time away from home made it impossible for them to really connect. And he's a fantastic adult parent. And he, by his own admission, he wasn't a very good child parent. He wasn't around. And it's also hard because you can't complain about it. You can't talk about it. You can't talk about how hard it is. Or your feelings ultimately about the absence of your father is poo-pooed a little bit because, well, he's doing the Lord's work. Well, didn't the if we're going to use the Lord's work as the measure of this scenario, then isn't the Lord's work also to be with your family? At what point in a typical LDS marriage do the needs of the wife come first? Where there isn't imminent death, the birth of a child,
right.
or some sort of scandal, when does she come first? She doesn't. And every single person is going to say, well, I put her first. I put her on a pedestal. She's my rock. She's the reason that I can do this or that. But that's about you. That's not about her.
So she's the one who does all the background work so that you can do all the public work.
Eric is asking, if we can't question the impact of our faith, how can we truly say that it is our faith? If we can't ask about it, how can we know that we truly are in it? How can we know that we truly are making choices driven by that faith if it's just assumed that we all know it and have to accept every element of it without asking questions? And I think the other element of Mormonism in general that he's exploring in this series of short plays is the impact of not only not being able to question, but the impact of being told that questions don't have answers. That was my experience as a growing up LDS, that whenever a question got too sticky, the answer was always, we don't have to know everything now. That will be revealed in the next life. I'm like, well, you know, that's really not going to help me right now. Anyone who's asking a question, being told that the question isn't answerable, and thus you shouldn't be asking the question, is going to do anything but bring up more questions that won't be verbalized. So if you continually have questions and you can't ask anyone around you for answers, what does that do to you? What does that do to your security within your faith and your self-identity that is tied to that faith? And your ability to have a sense of self within any interpersonal relationship. You're taught to give yourself over instead of stand your ground and declare who you are and build a life that supports that and celebrates that.
And so we're talking about is faith a dictatorship or is it a collaboration? And Eric seems to be showing us what happens when the dictatorship model is overwhelming and kind of the dysfunctional ways that we have to ask questions when it's a dictatorship instead of a collaboration. If it had been a collaboration, would these attempts at finding identity been less destructive?
How can faith drive goodness if it's a dictatorship?
So thank you, Jerry, for joining me for this discussion. I learned things that I never thought that I would learn. Very interesting insights into both Eric's process and into what Eric was thinking. And I still wish with all my heart that I could hear from Eric what Eric was thinking. But at least now we get to have the fun of interpreting with no boundaries.
And thankfully, his work is rich enough that it bears examination. It stands up, it just, yeah, and lends itself to more questions.
Few answers here. So once again, If you would like to read Peculiarities, you can do so at sunstone.org/Eric, E-R-I-C. We've also included a link to the Peculiarities film on YouTube. As Jerry said earlier, it was kind of a learning experience for most of the people who involved, so it's not the world's most perfect film shot for $10,000, but it's still quite interesting. And if you want to get a head start on our next episode, you can also read Borderlands while you're there, which has been described as Eric's most personal play. Thanks again for joining us for the Sunstone Podcast. We'll see you later.